history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. There are people who have done and endured incredible things for our country, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to meet today is 96 years young. He's a father to four, a grandfather to 13, 30 great-grandchildren, and the first great-great-grandchild is on the way. Quite a legacy that never really would have gotten off the ground if he hadn't survived a very close call in World War II. Maybe more than one. I know of one for sure. We're going to hear the story from Patch Curtis. We're sitting here in Modesto, California today, but you grew up in a place called St. David, Arizona. I bet most of our listeners don't know where St. David, Arizona is, but they know where a nearby town is. They probably heard a Tombstone. Did you grow up pretending to be Wyatt Earp and those guys, or what?
We used to go to the annual El Dorado program, and they reenacted all of those horrendous events that transpired there in the early days.
Well, I'm looking at a picture of you right here, and I'll put this at hometownheroesradio.com. But you've got your hat on, and that looks like a rifle taller than you.
Yeah, it was, and I was 3 years old at that time, and I've been in love with a gun ever since. And that belonged to Mr. Pearson, our next-door neighbor, and it was a pump. 22.
And you actually fired that gun at that age?
Later on, I didn't. At that age, I couldn't even pick it up.
I wouldn't think so.
Well, 4 or 5 years later, yes, I did. That was the back kitchen door of our house.
And I just said your name, Patch Curtis, and you grew up in a place that carried your family's name because your grandfather homesteaded that land in Arizona?
That's correct. He and his brother, Samuel.
They were sent out there by Brigham Young.
That's correct, in 1881.
So they were real pioneers.
I would think so. From what they said and the records they left, they were real honest-to-God pioneers.
So what was your childhood like?
Growing up immersed in Mormon heritage with all their stories and the good and bad, working on a cattle ranch farm, very successful farm, until September of 1926. My grandfather and his brother and all of their boy children had worked to build a concrete dam across the San Pedro River that supplied both of their farms with irrigation water. In September of 1926, there was a horrendous flood over the 100-year mark, as they talk about those flood stage things, that washed out the dam, and that washed out the ability to irrigate 100 acres of my grandfather's farm. Fortunately, I felt real good about fate and the fact that he had passed away 1 year before that happened. So he, at his demise, went out at the top of his game. He had a homestead that was operating in full score. We had dairy cows, bees, cattle, grazing, and 100 acres that supplied alfalfa, wheat, and corn on a rotation basis, and that was the basis of the income. However, the real money that made that farm possible was earned earlier on in the freight business. He and his brother owned several 20-mule team freight outfits. They owned a Six Forge blacksmith shop right on the Mexican border, at the border crossing of Naco. That's where they actually earned the money that helped make those places really successful farms.
And you lost your mother when you were just 7 years old.
I was 7 years old when she passed away.
And you were an only child.
I was the only child, that's correct. And I went to live with my father moved from our house about 3/4 mile to the main ranch house to live with my grandmother, her invalid daughter Nora, and a orphan that they took in to help with the chores around the place there. John Forrest was his name. He was about 12 years old when I moved up there with them.
You must have had a lot of chores to do, too.
I did, and resulting in a few switching down again when I failed to do it on time.
What was the toughest job around that farm that you had to do?
That's pretty hard to say. I thought they were all tough. I'd rather be doing something else, but chopping wood, picking up chips, bringing them in for starting the morning fire, collecting eggs, feeding the chickens, carrying slop to the hogs, milking cows, and doing all that kind of stuff, and bringing them up from the pasture and going down and getting the horses to bring those up when we'd want to saddle up and go chase cows.
So when you were doing all those tasks and daydreaming about your future, were you thinking, hey, someday I'm going to take over this farm? Or were you thinking, boy, I can't wait to get out of this farm?
Well, actually, I grew up thinking that that's where I'd spend the rest of my life, on that farm. And as things transpired, it didn't work out that way.
What changed? What altered that trajectory for you?
As my grandmother aged and the Depression came along, and along with the Depression was the horrendous closing of banks, which took all of the hard-earned cash that they had saved and put in the different banks, and that really put a crap into the situation. Along with that, after the Depression, along top of it came a horrendous drought situation that dried up a lot of the cattle feed and so on, which complicated the financial situation that existed there on the ranch. And the termination of that was that my father and his brother, who were running the ranch, decided that they had to part ways because there wasn't enough to support two families. The upshot of it was that my father sold his interest in the ranch there for $7,500, and he had to be off the premise by the 1st of January 1939. I was scheduled to graduate from high school on May the 18th, 1939, so I was allowed to stay on the old ranch house main building from January the 1st to May 18th. And that's what I did. I had a cow and I had some chickens and so on. Anyway, when my father left and I graduated from high school, that was the end of my idea and dream of staying there and spending the rest of my life on the ranch. I had wanted to go to the World's Fair in San Francisco that was on that year, and we enjoyed that very much. And then after about the fifth day, my father decided that it was time to go back to Arizona. And in the offing there, we had looked around for summer employment for me to work and earn a few dollars before I would go to Tucson to live my Aunt Clara and go to the U of A. Well, in the course of that, I found this job at Frieden Calculating Machine Company in San Leandro, California.
And for folks in 2017, they're saying, okay, a calculating machine. Now, what exactly does that mean? Because they've got a little phone in their pocket that does all the math they could ever want. What kind of machines were these and what were they for?
Okay, these were a 40-pound mechanical device that sat on gift talk that added, subtracted, multiplied, and divided.
And they weighed 40 pounds apiece.
And they weighed 40 pounds apiece.
Not going to stick that in your pocket.
No way. However, the thing of it was that when I went to work there, they were producing 25 of those per day. And they were finding immediate sale. Lumber yards particularly liked them for calculating board feet sales.
Sure.
And the scientific people liked it for calculating whatever they calculate. All the universities and schools liked it for their science classes, for their engineering classes, and so on, because they were more accurate. They work out many more points beyond zero than a slide rule and so on. So they were very popular and they sold. I took a look at my situation. I had a new suit of clothes. I had a new pair of shoes, a nice shirt. I had a new tie and a new hat. I had $40 in the bank, and if I went back down to Arizona, I'd have to live with my Aunt Clara. I wouldn't have any money. I'd have to go find another job and so on. I took a look at things and I figured, well, why would I go to Arizona and learn all about agriculture without any farm or ranch to go back to? And I talked to some of the people in the factory there and to my foreman and so on about what to do, and so I decided to stay with Freedom. I was in a movie theater at 90th and East 14th in Oakland, California on that Sunday morning, and it happened to be a wartime airplane movie on that had some famous actor in there. We only were in there maybe about 30 minutes when they turned the movie off, pulled the curtain and turned the lights on and said, "We have an announcement. All military personnel report to your headquarters immediately." And then the lights came back on and the movie came back on. Everything proceeded, but this was in the back of your mind. What is the military personnel doing being called up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, about a half hour later, they turned the lights back on and the movie went off. That's when movie projector announcer came out on the stage and said Pearl Harbor had been bombed and so on and so on and so on. Everybody got up and left. I don't know whether the movie went on or not, but I got on a bus and went back to San Leandro. That was the start of World War II. On Monday, instead of going to work, I got on the streetcar and the bus and went down to Oakland to the Marine Corps recruiting office. You had to wait to get in there for a few minutes and so on, but I had a quick interview with the recruiting sergeant there. After I talked to him a little bit about my target shooting skill and so forth, he said, "I notice you're wearing glasses." And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Are you nearsighted?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You know, right now we're not taking people with glasses and nearsighted. I don't think it'd be worth your while filling out the application." I said, "Okay, well, thank you," and got on the streetcar and bus and went back out and went to work. So I almost got into the Marine Corps on Monday, December the 8th.
But less than a year later, the tune had changed. They needed bodies like yours, huh?
That's right. By August the 13th, I was on my way. I was in a bus on the way over to receiving center in San Francisco, where we were stripped of all our clothes. There was 100 of us down there buck naked waiting to be interviewed by a doctor. And when I got there, he said to me, "Are you bored with all this?" And I said, "I sure am."
Well, since you had tried to enlist earlier, were you excited at the prospect of joining the military? No. Did you have reservations?
I had always been interested in the military, and because of my 3-month experience in the machine shop and being a tool and die apprentice, I was classified as material for the ordnance department. So I was sent to Aberdeen, Maryland for training. Basic training lasted for 6 weeks through all of the exercises and the combat courses and the obstacle courses and all that physical therapy that you go through and the training through the gas mask procedure and mess hall procedure and cleaning your barracks and be good soldiers and marching and drilling and so on. We got into some small rowboats that were tied with a large rope to a motor launch. And there was about 10 guys in each one of these rowboats. This motor launch was to pull about a string of about 5 of these across the river to Betterton Island, where our bivouac area was. We started out okay, but the storm came up. The launch ran into a headwind, so the wind was increasing and the boats were going like this and the water was coming over the gunnels. The motor launch didn't have enough power to outperform this headwind and looked like we might get a dunking, you know.
Uh-huh.
But fortunately, they poured on the gas and they finally inched ahead and they finally got us over to Betterton Island, but it was pretty exciting for a while. And as a result, there was about 6 inches of water in the bottom of these boats that we were in. A trip across was kind of exciting. After the basic training was completed, I was supposed to go down and start work in the machine shop for further training. The morning that I was supposed to go down there for that, I had a note there to go see Captain somebody there in another office, so I went and found him, and he said, "You, amongst other, has been selected cadre training Well, what's cadre training? That's for becoming non-commissioned officer. So, yeah, sure. I'd rather be a non-com than a private. He says, well, okay. And then instead of reporting down to the machine shop, he said, do you report over here to section so-and-so for cadre training? So we had another 4 weeks of cadre training. I came out of that with a corporal's certificate.
And were you already feeling an itch to get overseas and be a part of this?
Yeah, I did. We all felt that way, you know. But this was countered by what we were being told all the time, that we're all in this together. It's a teamwork, and everyone has used to the best advantage of the Army and to handle the wartime effort wherever we could, you know.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a pep talk to do what you can where you're asked to do that. Well, in this cadre training, that's emphasized to you again, you know, that everybody do their part. So as far as getting into combat, it was kind of sidetracked a little bit by the immediate problem right now of getting the cadre training and using that. After this cadre school, we found out that what they were wanted to do was open an ordnance training center on the West Coast, and that we new cadre were trained to go and staff this new ordnance training center, and it was at Camp Santa Anita. It was actually the Santa Anita racetrack that has been taken over by the Army as a training center. So we all were put on an Army troop train, the whole bunch of us, and this whole train had all of the personnel that it took to staff the opening of that training center. So we crossed country in this Army troop train, and this was quite a bit of difference in the trip east. We had gone in the first class in the sleeper cars and so on, and free meal chits down at the dining room and so on. Well, on a troop train, you were jammed into a thing four high on two sides of the aisle and a mess kitchen for just two meals a day. You'd get to go down to the mess car twice a day, and that's all. You didn't get three meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we got across the continent, and we wound up at around midnight at the Santa Anita, and they offloaded us, and our bunk that night was on the floor with a couple of blankets in the horse stalls of Santa Anita racetrack.
People still know Santa Anita, and, you know, next to the Triple Crown races, that's probably the most famous racetrack in the country. But so for these years, during World War II, there was no racing at all?
And no, they canceled all the racing, and at that track anyway, turned it into a training center. I, as a corporal, would have a group of 20 recruits that I would train. An event happened in North Africa that changed the course of my life there. What happened was there was a large ordnance regiment that was overrun by the German army and decimated. The reason this total decimation occurred was the fact that the ordnance people at that time were not being given infantry training and they weren't being armed. And so the army says, no more of this, soldier first and ordnance man second. So we set out to train all of the ordnance recruits before they got their technical training.
Patch would carry out that training and eventually receive his own opportunity to head overseas and join the 1st Cavalry Division in the Philippines. We'll hear how that unfolded, why he wanted so desperately to go overseas and fight, and how close he came to never making it home. Find photos of Mr. Curtis then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends and access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 96-year-old Patch Curtis, who still has his dog tag strung together with a blood-soaked shoelace from the day he earned his Purple Heart in the Philippines in 1945. We're going to get to that, but first, let's hear about his motivation. He spent his first couple years in uniform at various bases around the U.S., including the famous Santa Anita Racetrack. His time there even turned him into an extra for a war movie starring Edward G. Robinson. But the real thing was raging thousands of miles away, and Patch had an important reason that he wanted to get over there and do something about it.
The compelling reason was this. When I was at the boarding house in October of 1941, after I got home from work, there was a message on my bed and said, call Willard Pearson in San Francisco at this number. He was a former neighbor, a next-door neighbor from that. Where the house I was born, Mr. and Mrs. Pearson, Willard, and his younger sister, Virginia. Virginia was a year older than I was. We were chums, so we kind of grew up more or less together. Anyway, I went over and saw Willard, and he and his wife were in a hotel room in San Francisco with their little son, Mike. They had been given a two-month vacation in the States from their job in the Philippines. They were working for the Itaogan Mine Corporation in Baguio, P.I., Philippine Island.
Right.
Baguio was up on the north end of Luzon. I went over and visited one night with them, and I went back for the second visit with them. And Mr. and Mrs. Pearson were still in the Philippines, and Virginia had married a mining engineer from Canada, and he was also working in the same mine there. And Willard and his wife were going back. Well, they finally got their boat and went back. But that was October 1941. On December 8th, the Japanese picked him up and put him in prison camp, the whole family. So should I help if I can? Yes, I should.
So while you're in the Army and you're training these guys and all that, you're aware that your friends are prisoners in the Philippines.
That's right.
So your desire was to go to that part of the war and do what you could to set him free.
That's right.
And after a series of assignments at different bases across the United States, that opportunity to head to the Pacific finally materialized.
Was put on a 20,000-ton Victory model troop transport that had about 2,000 guys on it. We didn't know where we were going at that time, but we went out under the Golden Gate Bridge and so on. And 19 days later, we made landfall at Milne Bay, right on the southern tip of New Guinea. We were told that we were supposed to go up the coast to Oro Bay, and we were be unloaded there. And Oro Bay happened to be a replacement center for the Southwest Pacific at that time. So there were hundreds of us off at Oro Bay there. We spent our days there unloading ships with supplies and all that kind of stuff while we were waiting for assignment to whatever unit we would be assigned to. One of my tent mates was Roy Dunlap. Roy and I struck it off great because he'd been a target shooter back in Illinois, and he had trained as a gunsmith in one of the foremost gunsmith shops in the U.S. He later turned out to be a custom gunsmith and built custom guns down in Tucson, Arizona. His largest order were 30 special 6.5 guns for the Olympic shooting team. Roy and I both were assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division and were put on a ship and went up to Los Negros Island in the Admiralty Group. Roy was assigned on the initial landing group to go on up, and I was assigned to the group to stay on Los Negros and finish up. I didn't get to Leyte until November the 20th. They made the initial landing on Leyte October the 20th. I was assigned to the Troop B, 7th Cavalry. They had been in action, and they were in a replacement center, and I was one of the replacements that they got where they had lost from the action they'd been in. We were there for 5 days getting acquainted with my new squad and were put on trucks and trucks from Natunga, about center on the northern end of Leyte, and we were transported across to the northwest corner of Leyte at a place called Carragera. We were offloading the trucks on the beach at Carragera. That's where we formed up and headed up the Sagood Road across a place named Limon, up on the top of the mountain, heading south toward Ormoc, where the main body of the Japanese were. But in the meantime, the Japanese were in control of all of this road net off and on all the way south of Carragera. At the time we offloaded, there was a battery of 455 long toms firing across the island from Carragera Beach down to Ormoc, which was about 20-some miles. These 155-millimeter shells at Limon, we were right under the path of those bullets going over. Every time a salvo of four shells would go across, it would sound like a freight train going through the air over you. We had a tragic result there. These shells are 6 inches in diameter and they weigh 90 pounds. And the driving band to seal the gas that they go through the barrel is copper alloy that's driven into a dovetail around the base of the shell. Once in a great while, one of those will split and tear off due to the centrifugal rotation of the shell. It's thrown off at rather high speed. We had drained the top of the road at this place named Limon, and we were all laying down out of breath, catching our breath and so on. And one of these salvos went over, and one of the guys about four rows over, I heard a big, ugh! And looked over to see what happened. One of these rotating bands had came off and come down and cut him in two right to the spine. So that was our first close scrape of combat. But that afternoon we went on down our slope, and we had a firefight that afternoon down at the creek. We didn't suffer any casualties there, but we scored a few. We camped there, and that was the last real fresh water that we saw for the next 5 days. And the next morning, my squad was appointed point, and we went up a muddy trail. I could still see the footprints with water running back into it, for somebody was going up this muddy trail ahead of us. So I sent word back that we were right on the Japanese trail. Sure enough, about 15 or 20 minutes later, a guy pops out from behind the bush. I started delivering off shots with my M1 and stepped over to the left. My BAR man let go at him, and he was only less than the distance between me and Cindy there.
10 feet or so, less.
And we got out of that one okay, but he had turned out to be the equivalent of a major in rank, and he had a tremendous flag with hundreds and hundreds of signatures on it, and I got that flag. Next memorable thing was the Christmas morning, the dawn nice and clear with a lot of sparkling water drops that had rained during the night, and the sun as it came up on those just made every little glot of water look like a gleaming diamond, and the air was fresh and so on. But we missed our airdrop. There wasn't any food that day. All we had to eat that day was what we had in our pack, and all I had in my pack was one tropical chocolate bar.
I gotta ask you though, I mean, you've had a lot of years since then. You're talking about 1944. We're going to be coming up on Christmas 2017 before long. Has there been a Christmas since then where you didn't think about being back there in the Philippines on that Christmas morning with nothing to eat?
Never.
Gave you some perspective, huh?
Sure does.
And in a moment like that, do you think of family back home? Do you wonder if you're ever going to see them again?
Not really. You're so preoccupied with what you're confronted with right then, you hardly have a chance for daydreaming.
Every guy gives me a different response. Some people say, hey, I thought I was invincible. It was going to happen to everybody else and not me. Other guys say, I just knew at some point, you know, it was going to be me. Did you have a feeling one way or the other? I mean, were you scared? Were you concerned that you weren't going to get out of this?
Every time you're on the point, you're scared. Your adrenaline is pumping, you're scared, you're apprehensive. Is it now or...
Sure. There's nobody in front of you.
Right.
It's you and the enemy.
That's me and it.
And that was a familiar position for you? Something that you were doing regularly?
Pretty often, because they traded this point thing equal amongst the squads.
And you have an x-ray sitting right here that I'm going to make sure we get a picture of and put at hometownheroesradio.com. This is a recent x-ray, and it shows some souvenirs that you're still carrying all these years later. But before you got hit, before you were wounded, were there some other moments that you look back on now and say, hey, that was pretty close too?
Well, almost every one of those situations you get into, you say, got through that one. One of the other peculiar things is that me or him, Shorty Barrett comes to mind. Shorty Barrett was a fellow squad leader. The platoon sergeant was talking to us, giving us a kind of assignments and so on. And Shorty got hit in the chest, and he went down.
How far away was he from you when that happened?
Oh, 3 feet.
If they could hit him, they easily could have hit you.
Oh, easy, sure. Any one of us could have got it. But the peculiar thing about it is, after we got up on Luzon several months later, and Shorty got through his chest wound and came back, we were called together for the same reason, the same way. And who got hit? Shorty.
Twice.
Twice.
Did he survive that one too?
I don't know. I never heard. We never heard anything from him that time.
And Luzon is where you received your wounds.
Yeah, this is really the one dramatic wartime scene that you could ever see went off on the day that I got wounded. I was taken out on March 8, 1945. On the 6th, these big B-24 bombers began. We were all lined up down on a road at the foot of the mountains. The Yamashita line was the objective, and the town we wanted to get was Antipolo. On the 6th, the B-24s would come over in strings of three and drop 500 and 1,000-pound bombs on Antipolo and the Japanese fortifications that they could identify in that area. They came over a good part of the 6th and a good part of the 7th, off and on all day long, dropping these bombs. And we were a good 3-4 miles from there. But every time one of those 1,000-pound bombs would go off, your helmet would go like this on your head.
Rattle around a little.
4 or 5 miles away. Oof. Anyway, that went on. And then on the morning of the 8th, we were given instructions that there were going to be a 3-division push on Antipolo starting on 8 o'clock on March the 8th. No one had watches anymore because in the tropics and everything, watches and cameras just didn't, they just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
They just, the bands had rot off, so hardly anyone knew what time it was. But the 6th Division on the north, the 1st Cavalry Division in the center, and the 41st Division on the right. And if they're all in full strength, that would be 45,000 men. But to give you an idea, my squad was down 2 men. There was only 6 or 7 of us where there should have been 9. That was permitted all 3 of the division because we'd all been in combat for a couple of months and we had lost a lot of people for this reason and for that.
Sure.
Mostly illness and just being completely worn out. But the first thing that happened, an A-20A attack plane with a smoke started and they just laid a smoke screen 10 miles across the face of that mountain. They had 4.2 chemical mortars set up in intervals all down through that 10-mile section firing red smoke shells. And as these red shells would go up, they were spaced apart. Each unit was supposed to stay in that line that was delineated by these smoke lines. So when they made the blackout, these red lines started up, and we were given the order to go. So we went ahead. Now, our particular assignment that day was to take a artillery observation unit from a 155-millimeter howitzer battery and place them on their optimum observation point. We were supposed to escort them up and get them put down on the place where they were supposed to direct the fire from their battery. I had been on patrol in that day before and was most familiar with the area that they wanted to traverse, so I was appointed Point. So we started out at 8 o'clock up to the smoke screen after the massive artillery barrage went off ahead of us. And as we went up, the ground was filled with craters 12 to 18 inches deep. Ground looked like it had just been plowed with these shells. But we went on up, and when I say up, it was the base of a mountain, and as you went further up, it got steeper and steeper and steeper.
Sure.
We were pretty successful and didn't receive too much resistance, and only a couple of firefights on the way up. Till about 11 o'clock, we got up down a particular area. We ran into some resistance. The unit commander decided the best way to subdue the Japanese was we had a bazooka section that would fire bazooka shells, a 60-millimeter mortar section, and so they fired up all the bazooka shells. The Japs still continued to fire back at us. All of the mortar shells got used up trying to knock them out, so there weren't any more mortar shells available. So finally, platoon sergeant said to me, "Curtis, take your squad down and see if you can knock them out with grenades."
And those would prove to be very fateful orders, as we'll understand fully when we come back. We're going to hear how severely Mr. Curtis was wounded on March 8, 1945, and what it took to save his life. If you'd like to see a video of Mr. Curtis explaining his injuries, you can find that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with an amazing 96-year-old named Patch Curtis. He lives in Modesto, California now with his daughter Cynthia, but he's originally from St. David, Arizona. He told us how he tried to enlist in the Marine Corps a day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, only to be rejected because he was nearsighted. Later, he was drafted into the Army. He was training soldiers in the States, but wanted to get into the action in the Pacific because he knew his old neighbors, the Pearsons, had been captured in the Philippines, where they were working as civilians in a mining operation. His hope was to help set them free. And when we left off, Patch was on the same island where they were captured, Luzon. Bazookas and mortars had been unable to eradicate the enemy presence, so Patch's squad was ordered to try to sneak up on the Japanese and take them out with grenades.
We were up on the lee side of a hill where they couldn't get to us, so I went down the backside and around, and it was kind of an open swale down and a hill up on the backside over here, and I went around. I made sure all of them had four grenades and full belt of ammo and so on. Well, I started out with them down and went around and headed around here, and I said, "Let's pick up the pace. We don't want to be standing around too slow and make a good target." And so we started kind of moving a little faster, and we were firing as we were advancing. And one of my guys stumbled and went down, and as he went down, he almost hit me. He was pulling off shots as he fell down, and I turned and said, "You almost hit me. Get up." And he was down on his hands and knees like this. I kicked him in the behind, and he greatly started to get up and so on. And by then, the first bullet hit me over on the left shoulder here, and I figured, well, we were stopped. We were in wide open space, and we're not moving anymore. We're dead meat. So I started to turn to say, "Let's get out of here." And that's when the bullet hit me in the chest here.
What did that feel like?
It knocked the breath out of me, and I went down on my back. It spun me around. I couldn't get my breath. A fleeting thought went through, "Well, I guess this is it." But for some reason, I got my breath a little bit. Somehow I got initial shock. I guess my heart stopped or something too. I don't know. But anyway, a guy grabbed me by one leg and pulled me back around this point of this little hill and so on. I don't know how they got me back up on the top of the hill in the back. I was unconscious by then. I woke up. I remember the aid man was working on me, and they were giving me some morphine. And I remember when I'd breathe, it was going like that, and I tried to get my hand over here to close it up.
So you could tell that your lung was punctured?
Well, I didn't know. It just hurt, and I couldn't get my heart to get my breath. I was real short of breath, and I was coughing a little bit, and I was in and out after that. But when one incident, I woke up, and my fellow squad leader, a fellow by the name, my last name was Carmona, he had me in his lap, and the aid man had told him to keep my shoulder up so I wouldn't drown in my own blood. So he was kind of holding me up in his lap. And I thought, for Christ's sake, Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. He says, well, I'll get the aid man to give you some more morphine. And the aid man, Andy Anderson, he said, I can't give you any more. It'll stop your breathing. So I said to Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. So that was about 11 o'clock in the morning, as they later on they were able to kind of tell me. That went on all the rest of that day. They wanted to get a stretcher party up, but the Japanese had moved in on the trail behind, and they couldn't bring anybody here. No ammunition or anything. They couldn't get anything up to us. They were still in radio communication with the rear, but they couldn't make physical contact because the Japanese had intervened. And they decided that maybe after dark they could circumvent the Japanese. So sometime after dark, they got a stretcher party up there to get me in. And they had took six guys on the stretcher to get me down off of there. So I didn't get down to the 1st Medical Squadron Station till somewhere around midnight. And I remember one instance on the stretcher on the way down. I was in and out all the time, but one instance, a problem that I got kind of aroused. They couldn't figure out how to get me down off this level, but somehow they did. They laid us out in the yard before they finally got me into a surgeon, and all I can remember, somebody woke me up enough to say that I was getting my first blood transfusion. They showed me the name on the bottle there, and they read it off to me. Gaeus, G-A-Y-E-O-U-S. Gately, G-A-T-E-L-E-Y. Anyway, that was the first blood transfusion that I got.
And what all did they have to do surgically for you?
They didn't really do much except took out quite a few pieces. They reconstructed, later on they told me, what apparently had happened. I had a pair of binoculars on, and the bullet hit the binoculars first and disintegrated partially. So in the stuff that they took out of me was the pieces of binocular castings, piece of glass, leather from my wallet that was in my chest pocket here, piece of paper from stuff that was in the wallet, bullet fragments, and some of the bullet fragments they wrapped up. Here's the dog tags. That's all I got back with.
You were wearing these?
That's what I had on at the time.
You had this dog tag on at the time, and you saved it with the leather strap.
And it's still blood-soaked, and that shoestring is still soaked with my blood.
Wow.
And they were finding all that stuff in me, so apparently the bullet fragment, there's one large piece about as big as my thumbnail still down underneath there, and with that adhesive tape that's wrapped around them there that you see, they had a piece of the bullet fragments that they had found in the outer layers of skin there. All those pieces of stuff that you see shattered through there,
yeah,
that's a good part of that is binocular.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't, the binocular hadn't been on there, it's very likely the bullet would have gone through much cleaner.
And not spread out so much debris in there.
Yeah.
And they had to take out a couple of your ribs?
Yeah, that happened a year and some months after. These two ribs that they took out wouldn't heal. They developed osteomyelitis, and they were getting worse and worse.
But basically, the whole right side of your chest is crushed, destroyed, bruised.
Right.
Your lung was damaged.
Right. The first operation, they didn't think there was anything in the lung. It was collapsed. And when the lung collapses, apparently a hard coating forms on there, and they have to strip all that. They called it a decortication operation. They stripped that off before the lung can re-expand. Apparently they did that, but apparently there was still stuff in there because in January of 1946, I started coughing up blood. They couldn't figure out what that was, but they took a lot of pictures and stuff in there. Again, the veteran registration was completely overwhelmed. They couldn't find a bed to put me in. They wanted to send me up to some hospital up way up in Oregon, and I didn't want to go up there because I didn't know anybody. I had the job down there that I thought I would, because I went back to work on January the 1st.
Well, wait a second, though. You went back to work, but I know that one of the other effects of that injury, at least in the immediate aftermath, was you really didn't have the use of your right arm, right?
Yeah, right.
What, what kind of state were you in for the next few weeks after you got hit?
Initial medical help.
Yeah.
I was transferred to the 41st Field Hospital in Quezon City. That was a place to get your feet back underneath you and get a little weight going back and so forth. And I was there for several weeks. They moved us down on the docks in Manila and put us on a hospital ship for a general hospital down in New Guinea, back at Hollandia. I was on this hospital ship on April the 10th, my birthday, on the 12th of April, and the day that President Roosevelt died. That came in over the radio, that President Roosevelt. And then I wound up down in this 54th General Hospital in Hollandia for quite a while. That's where my arm wasn't working.
And when you say it wasn't working, you had no control of it all or no strength?
It was cold. I couldn't lift it. I could feel some. I could move my fingers and so on, but I couldn't do anything with them.
Because there was muscle damage from the shot you
right.
received.
And they also said there was probably some nerve damage.
Sure.
Which disappeared. That problem disappeared later on.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, well, how long did it take them to recover? And that's probably not a simple question, because in some ways you probably never recovered.
Yeah, that's right.
You've had to live the last 70 years without full respiratory function?
Right. I'm short 50% of my normal air.
How has that affected your everyday life?
It was entering at work, you know. These eager beaver bosses, you know, when they make a factory tour, they go out at full stride, you know. If I was in one of these parties, you know, by the time we'd get about halfway through a department, I would go and everybody would go, what's the matter with this guy? One other interesting aspect to this mental, I was walking down the aisle one day by the acetylene welding department, and you know when you hang acetylene torch up once in a while, it goes pop, 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 pop. I was walking by, this guy hung up his torch there, and it went pop, 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 and I found myself under this workbench over here.
You thought you were back in the jungle of the Philippines dodging bullets, huh?
Yeah, just like that.
And the other thing I've got to say, I don't want to be melodramatic, but we talked about your four kids and 13 grandkids and 30 great-grandkids and a great-great on the way. And after hearing your story, it sure seems like it's a miracle that any of them were ever born, because most people wouldn't have survived what you went through, and it sounds like it took a lot of help from a lot of other people to save your life.
That's absolutely true. I've had help all of my life, and that's another thing I marvel at. My grandmother picked me up after my mother died. My friends in San Francisco picked me up after I lost my place on the ranch. On and on and on and on.
And those guys had to drag you out of the spot where you got hit.
Yeah.
And they're risking their own lives in doing so.
Absolutely. All the way. And all the other people down the line that have ever had anything to do with. And you, now here, you're helping me spread the word, which is something I believe in. We need a lot of improvement in our patriotism in this country. We are in a wonderful country that we live in, and you only have to see the results of occupation like occurred in the Philippines that other countries do to you, and what it might have been like had they been successful in doing that to us, including the Japanese and the Germans.
And, you know, on the topic of your injuries, what do you attribute your survival to?
I really think I'm a lucky recipient of modern medicine. I'm sure that's what did it. Penicillin. I think I owe my life to penicillin.
That you didn't get infection, gangrene,
yeah.
Losing limbs.
Because in discussing this with doctors and so on, and what little I've read, in the Civil War, if you incurred a wound like this, you were gone unquestionably. That was it. in 10 days. And World War One, the best assessment any doctor's been able to tell me is that the calculated figures for a wound of this era was 2% in World War One. They didn't know what it would be in World War II because they had penicillin and they had sulfa. Well, here I am. So what's the percentage? Who knows? But yeah. It's pretty good. Well, it's, and I'm one of them.
Yeah, and you're still going. Well, I don't want to forget this. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. Have you ever had a moment where you resented what happened to you or you felt that it wasn't fair? You wish that it hadn't happened? Has it affected your life to that degree where you felt you didn't get a fair shake?
No, I don't think I ever looked at it that way. I do look at it like, yeah, I'm a victim of fate. I wish I hadn't had to go through some of that stuff. But that's the luck of the draw. Because I've survived and I'm here and I've seen a lot of neat things since, I'm pretty darn lucky.
I had a feeling that was your perspective.
Yeah.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I guess I never really tried to analyze that thought of what I would be most proud of, but right now, off the cuff, I'd say I'm glad I was able to do something for my country.
And I know I've mentioned these totals of your descendants a few times, and I only do so because it's an impressive number, but the reality is none of them lived through any of this. So it's not as real for them as it was for you. For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't see any of this, who didn't understand what could have been and what almost was, what do you think we need to know about you and all the guys like you who risked their lives for our country?
I would like to hope that we could all be aware of what it took, of what it was and what they did, and order their lives accordingly, and also somehow gather the feeling that they too could make a contribution like that if they were called on to do that.
And the last thing I have to ask you, and feel free to add anything else, but you made it very clear how close you came to not coming home, to adding to that number of over 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. How often over the years have you thought about some of those guys you knew who didn't come home?
Almost every day. And it's kind of interesting. With the computer, it's been able to give me a greater understanding of what happened to some of them. For example, this Carmona that I mentioned, he lies in the Roswell Cemetery. He was given a Silver Star for his action the next day after I was wounded in killing the Japanese that stopped me. The other one that I turned up, I mentioned earlier that I stepped aside to let my BAR man shoot this first Japanese. He received a Distinguished Service Cross for his actions on March the 9th, along with Carmona, in subduing the Japanese strong point.
And am I understanding that they were both killed that day?
They were both killed. They were both awarded their awards of Silver Star and Distinguished Service Cross posthumously.
And with Carmona, so people remember, you're saying he was killed the day after you were hit, but what you shared with us is that he was one of those who helped save your life by cradling you and holding you upright so you didn't drown in your own blood.
Absolutely, and a day later he was dead. So I forever have a debt to him. I think about some of this stuff every day.
For a long time.
Yeah, and probably will. It's kind of tough. I keep telling my oldest son, I said, I don't know why in God's world I spend so much time thinking about it. And I think Cynthia probably gets tired of hearing me about it. And any of the grandkids that spend any time with me probably, well, it's a part of me. So,
yeah, and they wouldn't be here if you didn't survive it.
Yeah.
Hard to argue with that one.
I make a long story out of it. It sounds like a whole lot of things and so on. But remember, I was only in combat 5 months. Other guys, many, many other guys, were in those same circumstances, under those same dirty physical conditions, the mental strains, the whole world, for weeks and weeks and months and years. So they contributed far more than I ever did.
That's what I need to ask you. Whatever happened to the Pearsons in that prison camp?
Oh, I forgot to bring that point out, and I'm glad you brought that up. And that Mrs. Pearson died, Willard's wife died, little Mike died. Mr. Pearson, Willard, and Virginia and her husband came home.
Well, and I know you're not looking for attention or glory or credit, but you told me your motivation for wanting to go over there was the fact that they were imprisoned there. And you were part of the effort that liberated the Philippines and led to their liberation from that camp. Does that give you some satisfaction?
Yeah, it does. Oh, absolutely.
Pretty amazing story, isn't it? Pretty amazing man. Patch Curtis, 96 years young. Find photos and that short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.